I am happy and honored to welcome today to the Radio Cafe Linda Mary Montano. I just said it wrong. Linda Mary Montano. She is a performance artist, and the exhibition Linda Mary Montano, Always Creative, opens at Site Santa Fe this Friday. And Janet Dees is here. She's assistant curator at Site and curator of this exhibition. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, I mean, I've been aware of your work for many years, Linda, and you have spent your life in such an interesting place where, I guess you would say, art and life are connected or really are one and the same thing. And what does that mean? I mean, how is it different from maybe another kind of art that's separated from life?
I'd have to segue back to everything segues back to our childhood and what we did or didn't do or how we were raised, how things happened, didn't happen. And I was a verbal, I came upon the title selective mute in my travels, and I wasn't that, but I call myself that. I visioned, I saw, but I didn't hear, and I didn't speak. And I really did, but I'm saying I didn't speak until I was in my 30s. So the oral world, or the world of sound, or the world of communication was not something that I had access to. And I found myself needing to practice how to live, how to be, how to know, how to communicate via my art so that my life would get better. And I needed to practice how to feel, how to reset the trauma button, how to untrigger. And I did that via art.
And what specifically did that look like early on?
It looked like sculpture, and I majored in sculpture, so it was very hand-oriented and silent. And then for my MFA show at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I presented chickens, live chickens, in minimal art size, like 25-foot long by 15-foot-wide cages, three chickens in each cage, and it was very minimally and conceptually oriented. And then the segue fast forwards to my appearing as the chicken woman, who was really what I call live angel, dead chicken, or the chicken who becomes the statue, the Catholic statue, the saint, the Mary, the sculpture, living sculpture. And then I started seeing myself as a living sculpture. And then a living sculpture that moved, that talked, that sang, that performed. And then we're right up to now.
There are so many pieces that are really, that you've done, that I think are really challenging for what you might say a mainstream audience, or really for anybody. I mean, in one performance, you spent a full year tied to another person with a length of rope, and you lived within several feet of each other but never touched. And it seems like such an interesting example of an artwork where so much of the, so to speak, performance is really experienced most by the two of you, not so much by us, except maybe in our imaginations. Let's talk about that piece. What was it like, and how did you let other people know what it was like?
I think I'd like to go back, actually, to other previous endurances that were sensory oriented. So there was a whole bevy of blindfold pieces where I live without sight for a week, usually no longer than a week, and I lived in galleries because the subtext was I never went to summer camp, so I set up shop in galleries as a camping site. And I went to Georgia O'Keeffe's show today, and I always go back to her little tent and the fact that the gallery has become Georgia's camping place, and her astral body is still in that little tent. And these endurances of handcuffing and being tied down in vow form relates to having been a nun for a couple of years and taking vows and enduring and learning by taking away. And very, very privately. So the public aspects of all of these, I'm not going to pick one, but all of these were that I would change either conceptually or emotionally, and then my life would get better, or I would be a better a communicator or a better compassionator in daily life. The audience was never that important to me. I never did anything for audience. As time went on, as I made mistakes in work that then had consequences for audiences, and as I grew up and as the audience taught me or gave me energy, the audience was always my energy magnet, giving me. And as I got more, then I was able to kind of come out of my hybrided shell and my cage and think about them and think about what was best for the audience or best for the viewer. But it was never my concern. It was never my concern. I was just going to do what I was going to do no matter what and with no consequences for anyone else. But I learned there are consequences.
What's an example of some consequences?
There's one that I talk about in my book, Art in Everyday Life, which is now going to become, thanks to Janet, Inside Santa Fe, it's going to become You Too Are a Performance Artist. And I did a piece called Talking About Sex While Under Hypnosis, and I wasn't thinking about the fact that my husband was in the room. And so I learned, go to therapy first, Linda. There are other people in the room, always. There's always somebody in the room, mentally, physically, via the airwaves. And consequences are just absolutely important, but it took me years to learn about consequence.
We started, before we went on the air today, you said a little prayer, and the three of us sitting here at the table connected, and it seems like whether you call it religion, spirituality, religious belief, religious practice, these forms of human experience come into your work and you draw on them and you use them. What is this like for you? How do you think about it?
I've never had a physical child, so I've never had that sense of the sacred, human sacred, my womb bearing and then giving birth to. And I think it's a very, very important job and service that women do and have and give. And so also being Catholic trained in the semi-mystic traditions of union and visualization and joining and the unitive way, so to speak, my work becomes that. My work becomes a place where I can have that experience of childbirth and have that experience of union. And I'm really greedy for that. I'm really hungry for that. And I'm really make that happen. And that's my job. That's my vocation. And the nun being in a convent was sort of semi-training. And then being visual, I was able to travel through visualization. So I like getting... the bottom line is I like getting high, and I use art to get high.
We're talking to Linda Montano, and Janet Dees is the curator of the show Linda Mary Montano Always Creative, which is opening in Site Santa Fe in a couple of days on Friday. Now, how did you come to this? How did you come to choose Linda and get to know her work and do this show?
Well, Linda's work, her work is something that I've been interested in for a while. It stemmed from some previous research I was doing about performance art, and particularly about this idea of documentation of performance art, about how, you know, because it's a medium that's ephemeral and time-based, there's not a, you know, it's not a painting or a sculpture, like about how we as audiences can experience a work of art that took place in the past, but that doesn't have a physical form. And I started got very interested in her work, And so when this opportunity arose at Site Santa Fe, I thought it would be a wonderful thing to connect with Linda and to create a show out of her work.
There is a challenge inherent in that, which is you are working with a performance artist mm-hmm. and doing a museum show where she's not there most of the time. Mm-hmm. So how did you think about that, and how do you do it?
Well, we talked a lot about that because one of the things, you know, it is sort of a semi-retrospective in the sense that we're looking at work that's from the 70s all the way up into the present. And so we wanted to think about ways of activating the exhibition space so that it really engages the viewer. I'm writing an essay for the book comes from a quote that Linda says that says that the primary document of a work of art is the change in the performer and the viewer. So thinking about how we could elicit that rather than, you know, sort of getting the gist of the idea. So we devised a couple of strategies to do that. Well, first of all, she'll be doing an opening and closing performance. So sort of thinking about how often we could have her there. So there'll be a performance at the opening and then one at the closing. And she'll also do art life counseling, which is a set of performance work that she's done. And that'll be via Skype a couple of times during the exhibition.
What is art life counseling? Do you want to talk about that, Linda?
Well, I would like to give my hugs and embrace to Janet publicly for really finding me, because I'm not necessarily on the public path, and this has been such a joy and so exciting to be found by her and to be re-seen by her and to be recontextualized and to be in collaboration with her and Site and Irene Hoffman and all the people there. I mean, it's a team. It's an incredible experience. If you've never walked into a gallery or a museum when they're installing a show, it's unbelievable. Anyway, yeah. I'm in awe. And art life counseling began when I was doing 14 years of, or 7 years of living art. Marcia Tucker, RIP, Marcia Tucker, an incredible visionary, gave me a room at the New Museum for 7 years that they painted every year the color that I was wearing, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, white. And I knew that I wouldn't go into New York without a program or a reason, so I incorporated into the vow taking of 7 years of living art that I would go to New York once a month and sit in the window on Webster or Worcester Street side, not Broadway side, of the old New Museum, and do art life counseling, which at that time I was a wild child artist doing whatever I wanted, wherever I wanted, and I was doing tarot, palm, psychic readings, etc., and being come to me because it was wonderful and fabulous, and I was really good. I was really good at it. And then I started teaching at University of Texas, Austin, and I had students who were, in a sense, my children, my babies, and I started seeing consequences, and I started seeing how do I make these new artists to be people of wisdom and compassion and consequence, and I started re-seeing how I was in terms of the world, and I went back into Catholicism, and I went back into, okay, I'll let go of the palm reading, X on the palm reading, and then I'll let go of the tarot, okay, tarot cards are gone, and I'll let go of the psychic readings, okay, psychic readings are gone, but I still sneak looks at people's hands. I must confess, bless me, Mary and Janet, I have sinned, I do look at people's hands, and I do psychic readings, even though I don't call it that. Anyway, so now I pray with people. And it works, you know, we talk and then they do their thing and pray and like that.
The piece that you talked about, which you've done in, I guess, a number of different series, but you dressed for a year in the color representing, as you said, the rainbow and then white, and each one of them represented one of the chakras, which are the energy points in the Hindu metaphysical tradition, and you focused on the meaning of and the experience of each chakra very intensely for that year. And in the show, which I just got a little sneak preview of, the clothing, some of the clothing that you wore is there, and kind of arranged in that order in the rainbow pattern. And I remember when you started doing that, I was following performance art at that time, and I thought, now wait a minute. In real life, one is presented with all sorts of energies all the time. I mean, when you're in a red year, what about if all these kind of blue energy events come your way? What do you do? Do you reject the things that life is giving you that are not part of the energy of that year?
What I found that it was the performance of a control freak, really, that I was absolutely. I love designing my life and make it work according to my thinking, and this was a perfect piece for me because I had mentors, living or dead mentors, who I sort of used as guides for the year. I had a focus. I lived in a colored room for a number of hours a day and listened to one tone. I completely immersed myself in the color, the sound. I talked in an accent with everyone but my blood family. So first year was a French accent and a country western accent, and it was crazy, wonderful, wild. And as things began happening according to the quote, then what I called chakras, which I now call glands. I'm very generic and do only glands now. Things began happening, and I'll move to the heart center, heart year. And in the heart year, my dog died. My a relative, brother-in-law, dear brother-in-law, and my mother died. So the heart was something else happened, but I'd have to go back to remember. Things happened according to the year that I was in. What I learned was that I was so controlling it and so focused and so in demand that my life match my concept, that by the end of 7 years, maybe even by 5 years, I was completely not enamored by my concept, but more by what I was learning, which was let go. And there's nothing I can do that's going to make any difference. But I did hold on to the clothes, and I went on the slide down from the top of the head down back to the first. By then, it wasn't yet gland. It was still called chakra. And I did a virtual meeting in the Chagall Chapel, and I took no photographs for that 7 year, and I redid the drawing that I had done with my right hand. I redid the same drawing with my left hand, and I completely stopped. And I think, you know, I haven't talked to Janet about this, but I think my life now is about learning how to stop. So I'm in the process of, not boohoo, but I'm kind of in the process of stopping my video career or video work or video push. So it's like, if things become a push, I have to then ask, is it time to unpush and not do the labor pains and not do the birth pangs and enjoy the child that's been born, and enjoy the number of years. I love death. I'm sorry, I do. I'm a deathaholic. I love death. And
all right,
you're gonna have to explain that a little bit more.
No, I love thinking about how many years do I have left, and how am I going to use them, and how do I want to feel, and what do I want my body to be vibrating, and whatever. How many hertz, H-E-R-T-Z, not H-U-R-T-S, but am I in the right frequencies? I've done quite a few pieces on death, and So death is a great teacher, but that's going back in time to the 70s and what was the book, Castaneda.
Right, right. Janet, this is opening. Linda Mary Montano, always creative. This Friday, now there's a couple of other shows opening as well. State of Mind, New California Art Circa 1970, and Mungo Thompson, Time, People, Crickets, Money. And do these shows, I mean, they're three separate shows, but do they all sort of coordinate with each other?
They are three separate shows, but they're related to one another. Irene Hoffman, who is our chief curator and director at Site Santa Fe, is curating Mungo Thompson's show, and I'm curating Linda's show. And State of Mind, New California Art Circa 1970, is a show that's curated by two curators, Karen Moss and Connie Llewellyn. And Irene and I decided to bring State of Mind to Site Santa Fe, and we thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to do two companion shows that related to State of Mind. So, for example, Linda, toward the beginning of her career, spent a lot of time working in the Bay Area, and a lot of her early performance works are represented, some of her early performance works are represented in State of Mind. So her show kind of starts with State of Mind generation and brings it to the present. And then Mungo Thompson is a younger California-based artist who was influenced by a lot of the artists in State of Mind. And some of them were his teachers, people like John Baldessari and Ed Ruscha. And so we thought it was a nice triangle that you see State of Mind, you have this larger context, and then you get a focused look at Linda Montano's work, and then you get a focused look at Mungo Thompson's work.
So this all opens on Friday at Site Santa Fe, here on Paseo de Peralta in Santa Fe. And on Friday from 12 to 7, Linda will be doing a performance called Singing My Heart Out. And then on Friday, May 17th, at the end of the show, there will be another 7-hour performance, Singing My Heart In. For more information, sitesantafe.org. Linda Mary Montano, performance artist, and Janet Dees, curator at Site Santa Fe, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Grove Burnett. He is a teacher of mindfulness. He's founder of the Vallecitos Mountain Ranch. He's an environmental lawyer, and he's going to be teaching some applied mindfulness trainings here in Santa Fe, starting next week at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about mindfulness. Is that the same thing as meditation practice?
It is. It's part of the meditation practice. Mindfulness is best defined, and this is based on the explosion in the science of mindfulness in recent years. And researchers define mindfulness as an awareness of our experience and events in the present moment. It's being fully present. And the best way to understand it, I have found, is to understand that there are two different modes of consciousness. This is how modern psychology frames it. We have the doing mode of consciousness, which is critical, analytical thinking, problem solving, figuring things out. These are the skills, the strategies we employ every day in the details of our life, navigating through our lives. But there's an alternative capacity of mind, or mode, or pattern of consciousness, which is called, the psychologists call it the being mode of consciousness, which is mindfulness, which is a simple, relies simply upon the power of awareness and not that of critical thinking. You know, the word mindfulness or meditation is misunderstood so often in our culture. You frequently hear people say, well, I'm going to go meditate on that, on my relationship, on my problems at work, whatever the circumstance of their life might be. That's not meditation. That's thinking about things and employing analytical problem-solving skills. That's a mode of consciousness that we need to navigate through our, particularly our external problems and our external circumstances of our lives. But there's an alternative to thinking about things. So meditation is not thinking about things. It's actually an alternative to that. It's simply being present and observing what is arising in the present moment in our bodies. What are the sensations arising? What's arising on the mental landscape? Is there agitation, nervousness, angry, whatever it might be, and not getting involved with it? I call it an uninvolved receptivity.
Detachment, so, as
detachment,
they say.
Or the better word is non-attachment. Detachment implies not caring, just turning your back and jettisoning it all. That's not meditation at all or mindfulness. Mindfulness is looking directly into the circumstance of our life, but not becoming involved in it with the content. For instance, a story that's going on in your mind about your work situation. Your supervisor you're having a lot of difficulty with. The whole story can build up around that, and we get caught into the content of the story itself, and pretty soon we're thinking this, and we're off, we're gone, right? The mindfulness way of doing it is simply to hold it as a mental event, rather than identifying with the content of it, of just sitting and being with it, observing it. And this quality of being mode, the mindfulness as we call it, which is an ancient practice, 2,500 years old after all, is a completely different way of knowing than thinking about things. Completely different mode of consciousness than critical thinking and problem solving. And it is actually the seat of all our wisdom. It is the seat of insight. It's that place of intuition that we all have experienced and do experience at times. And mindfulness and meditation simply cultivates this capacity of mind. And it's not that one is better than the other, the doing mode or awareness is better than thinking or critical analytical skills. It's just critical analytical skills of thinking and problem solving have eclipsed this innate capacity that all of us have of simply being present and observing carefully and with discernment what is happening in the present moment. Einstein said often that his best ideas came to him when he was not thinking about things.
Well, that's true of, I think, everybody. We've all had that experience.
Absolutely. And all the mindfulness practice is cultivating that capacity. It's not, we're not actually going and constructing something that doesn't already exist and is not a mental faculty of the mind. We're simply developing it. We're nurturing it. We're training it. Because we have so little attention, and so we honor that mode of consciousness so little in this culture of ours. Everything is all about doing and getting and building.
Winning. I mean,
and winning.
You're
yeah.
a litigator. You're
yes.
a trial lawyer. It's such a different way of, I mean, how do those two ways of thinking, on the one hand, getting your case in order and doing everything you've got to do to win, and on the other hand, the sort of mindfulness and non-attachment to the outcome.
Exactly. But they're so complementary, because you have to employ the critical analytical thinking, the planning, the organizing, the figuring it out, putting your case all together. On the other hand, there's a place for actually just abiding in the mode of being, of observing, and that's where the great insights come, not only on particular cases that you may be working on or in your work thing, but also as to the existential questions that all of us are confronted with in our lives. You know, who are we? Where
right.
did we come from? Where are we going? Those kinds of questions cannot be answered by sitting down and thinking about them. They can only, the answers emerge the degree to which we can cultivate this place of presence, of simply sitting still, even for 10 minutes a day. Does not require huge time or discipline. Will have enormous benefits in all respects.
We're talking to Grove Burnett about mindfulness. Now, I was thinking as I was preparing to converse with you about the meditation courses that I've done in the past that are in the Buddhist tradition. And Buddhism, a lot of the time, really bills itself as a non-religion that doesn't require faith. And at the same time, there's a lot of components to it that aren't necessarily directly related to the mindfulness practice, and yet they are. And I wonder what happens when you start pulling them apart. I mean, is it like, do you miss pieces? Like when you can take all the nutritional components of an apple, but it's healthier to eat the apple.
Well, that's a good question. I have trained and practiced in the Buddhist tradition for 30 years and been teaching for almost 20 years, and I'm authorized to teach in that tradition, and I do. I teach Buddhist retreats from 2 days to 2 weeks long. But all along, my particular interest has been, particularly in the last two decades, is mindfulness, which is the sort of basic teaching that comes from the Buddhist traditions, has been lifted out and put into a vehicle that is secular, that is non-denominational, and therefore more accessible to people. For instance, when I teach this course every year at the Unitarian Church, which is 6 weeks introduction to the mindfulness practice, I do it in a completely secular, non-religious, non-denominational way. And what happens is that draws so many people who have always wondered, you know, what is the deal here with meditation and mindfulness, particularly in Santa Fe, where we have all sorts of, you know, stuff going on. Weird stuff going on.
So people don't want to sign up for the gongs and the...
They don't. Yeah. They don't. You know, it just doesn't work. So what happens at the Unitarian Church, which is a very neutral place for people to come, like, oh, yeah, you know, there's no baggage there because the Unitarians are great, is that people come who would not come to a Buddhist meditation retreat, but who are interested in what is this skill, what is this technique of simply being fully present with our experience, what benefits does it have in my life, how can it transform the way I relate to my life and the changing circumstances of my life. So I get 125 people show up who would never show up for any sort of religious, Buddhist or otherwise, teaching or retreat.
Now, what do you actually do in the classes?
It's a combination of two things. One, you cannot understand mindfulness meditation because it is, at its essence, an experiential activity unless you do it. So we have very basic instruction, and we do a sitting, several sittings beginning 20 minutes long with instruction. And then I do some lecturing and talk about what is mindfulness, as you and I are doing, what are its benefits, how can it be applied in my daily life, and then we do some more sitting. And then I introduce over the course of 6 weeks different exercises you can employ in your daily life to actually apply this practice in a very practical way in how we live our lives.
And so people come out of that with basically a different set of tools than they had when they went in.
That is my intention, that they come out with a new set of skills that all of us inherently have, mind you. This is not, you know, dreamed up in Santa Fe 6 years ago or anything. But these are ancient techniques and tools that have been mastered and developed over millennia. And yes, my hope is, and it happens, is that people will leave using, being able to use a new skill, a new technique, and hopefully, and this happens, that they'll go to a longer training instead of a evening training for 6 weeks. They'll come to a 2-day retreat or a 3-day retreat, where it's a deeper immersion in the practice itself, which can be a profound experience for people to enter that place of silence It is just so unusual in our society.
Yeah. Well, here we are in the baking company, which is not a place of silence, but beautiful things do happen here.
I know they do.
And it's interesting because I think one of the things that comes out of this type of practice is when you talk about generating world peace or local peace and harmonious interactions among people, it really does start with individuals turning off their reactive apparatus and just starting to listen.
Absolutely. And observing and just not, as you say, not reacting. Instead, we can make a choice of how we are going to respond to a circumstance in our life. We don't have to react from old habitual patterns, which usually cause ourselves harm or somebody else harm. Instead... Unless you've got good patterns, but most of us have good and bad. It's a mixed bag for most of us. And you do have that choice, therefore, of being able to make the decision, what is the most appropriate way for me to respond here in this situation? How can I respond from a place of compassion, of caring, of understanding, not meaning I'm going to let the situation leave tire tracks across my face. You can be very appropriate and be firm, if not fierce, about what the appropriate action is. But if it's coming from that place of non-attachment that we were talking about earlier, it's going to be much more skillful.
So you are, among other things, an environmental lawyer, a litigator. So have you cultivated compassion for... oh, I don't know, greedy polluters and things like that?
That is the practice. And there was a stage about 15 years ago in my career where these two came together. I was sort of practicing law as a young, aggressive, very successful, in-your-face warrior. And then I was doing this mindfulness practice over here. And when I brought the two together and actually integrated the practice into my practice of law, it completely transformed how I practice law.
Were you a better lawyer?
I was definitely a better lawyer. I was definitely a better lawyer. And I was able to sustain myself in a better way. Because when I sat across the table, as I often would, with these really high-powered corporate lawyers who use anger, aggression, hostility as their primary weapons, I could, if I'm not attached and was practicing, instead of immediately reacting, which I was very good at because I can be just as aggressive as any other lawyer, but I could see that they were acting from a place of suffering themselves. And that just sort of would turn the whole thing. I didn't have to give in anything. I just didn't have to respond to that and escalate it.
Right.
It was really interesting. And there were some cases, not always, where I would actually have compassion for some of these people who obviously were in such turmoil and such deep suffering, as most lawyers are anyway, particularly trial lawyers. And it would be a real revelation and change my whole approach of what's the best strategy here for us to be able to come to an agreement that accomplishes both our purposes.
Did it change them?
That's a good question. I don't know. You know, I never... It would change their attitude or their preconception of me, which had been pretty well established as one gets as a very aggressive trial lawyer. And, you're not the SOB that preceded you in your reputation. Yeah, it's very interesting, that intersection. And this is applied mindfulness. This is where you really take, where the rubber hits the road of, can you take cultivating this different way, mode of consciousness directly into your life, into the life circumstances, and apply it so that you are more skillful and you are more compassionate in how you live your life.
We're talking to Grove Burnett about mindfulness. Now, the classes start on, well, the Mindfulness 101 starts on February 26th, and Mindfulness 102, which is for intermediate practitioners, starts on February 27th, and they run through early April. There, so that's Tuesday and Wednesday evenings, weekly at 6 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. And let's see, if somebody wants to sign up, where should they go? Or
the easiest thing to do is to go to our website for Vallecitos, VallecitosOrg.
Vallecitos.org. And the Vallecitos Mountain Ranch is outside of Santa Fe, and it's a very, I haven't been there, but I gather it's a very peaceful place where you do longer events of this nature.
Yes, we do longer trainings, mindfulness trainings, and retreats. It's right in the middle of the Carson National Forest between Tres Piedras and Tierra Amarilla, if you've ever taken that drive over the top. We're
right.
12 miles in from pavement, so it's an inholding of 135 acres. It was homesteaded in 1898. We're surrounded by 300,000 acres of Carson National Forest. A mile of the Vallecitos River goes through the ranch. There are seven little mountain lakes on the property, and a lodge, huge log cabin lodge that was built in 1928 and patterned after the Lodge of Yellowstone, with huge cathedral ceilings and walk-in fireplaces. So it's the quintessential place to, as Henry David Thoreau said, to go to the woods, to live deliberately, to front only the essentials of my life. And that's what we really offer, it as a sanctuary for people to come and come home to themselves. And in our longer retreats, which may be 2 or 3 days long, for the most part, we do them in silence when we're doing the meditation practice of sitting and walking with instruction, and then talks about how it applies in our lives. And then in the afternoon, we go out and we walk in the wilderness that surrounds the ranch. So it's a really exquisite, it can be, and this has just been confirmed for the last 20 years, it can be a life-changing experience for people.
And it's both, it sounds like it's both a kind of individual and then group activity, depending
yes.
on the retreat and the time of day in the retreat and so on.
Exactly. In the afternoon, we all take a hike together,
yeah.
you know, off the ranch. Into the we're bordered on the south by the La Manga Management Unit, which is the largest remaining old growth forest in the entire Carson National Forest. I mean, it's a sad to say, it's 5,000 acres, but it's absolutely stunning ponderosa old growth, like all of that country used to be pre-settlement.
Right. Grove Burnett is a teacher of mindfulness and founder of the Vallecitos Mountain Ranch, which is on the web at vallecitos.org, ValleCitos. And for those who want to call, the number is 575-751-9613. I'll put a link to it on my website, santafe.radiocafe.org. And once again, Mindfulness 101 and 102 start in the last week of February at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Grove, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Angela Keane. She is promoter of an event called Girls Power. It's an all-age electronic dance music show at Warehouse 21 that's happening this Friday, February 22nd at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, this is great. This is basically young DJs plying
yes.
their trade at Warehouse.
Yes, and they're all female DJs. We have 5 female DJs, Dirt Girl, Kayla, Teddy No Name, Pez, Amy Bass Cakes, and we're very excited to have all of them.
Now, it's electronic dance music, yes. But each one of them has a different style?
Yes, they do. We're going to have dubstep, trance, electro, beats, house. It's all of the above. They're basically just going to fill the crowd and see what they want to play, but the girls are all very, very experienced DJs. So
very interesting. Now, there's, I mean, not as many female DJs
no.
as we wish there were in this
there's
lovely
not.
World.
They're hard to find. And I get five was really lucky.
What's up with that?
I don't know. I think a lot of times it just became a man's world, and it still kind of is. But they're, you know, coming out and doing amazing and having bigger followings than anybody can imagine. So they're doing very good.
That is great. Now, where do they learn their skills?
They all have some of them they learn it on their own. I know a couple of them have mentors, other DJs. I know that some of their mentors are DJ Luna, and then Mark Afar is another mentor. I believe Coder is a mentor. But a lot of the girls mostly, you know, learn on their own, just feel it.
Now, this is an all-ages show, so
yes.
Basically it's something that they're... We kind of wish there were more of in this town.
Yes, it's all about the music. It's not at a bar, so there's not anything to worry about with the drinking. It's just about the music and the good company. And there's going to be a lot of fun things. We have a free self-defense class. It's going to be fun seeing the superheroes beating up other superheroes and a lot of booths, circus dancing. It's
now, that's
fun.
Something that you do?
Yes, I do circus dancing. My group is performing.
What's your group called?
We're called the Pyrofessionals.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a great pun.
Yeah, we're mostly fire dancing, but now we do it all. And we started with Zozobra, and now we're just kind of expanded.
So it's not just a dance music show, but all kinds of other
things.
It's
turning into like a little festival in the warehouse. Everyone's just been really wanting to be attached and really eager about this and been saying, can we do it? And we haven't been turning any away, so... We're getting a lot of fun things to do.
When you have all ages shows in
yes.
this town, do all ages really show up? I mean,
yeah.
What's the range?
Actually, it's very surprising. The last show we did, Kicking It Old School, we thought it was just going to be a bunch of teenagers. But we had all of the old school candy kids and all of the old school ravers from, like, you know, the 80s and 90s. And they were in their full candy beaded tuxedos and everything. It was really cool. And we had all ages, the new school and the old school. And we're hoping that that happens again. But our youngest that came was 8 years old with his brother. And our oldest, I believe, was around their 70s.
Wow.
It's really fun. It was a fun event.
So this is an event that's happening this Friday, and it's sponsored by Froggert Yogurt.
Yeah.
And there's a story behind that.
Yes. Oh, Froggert Yogurt, they're just beautiful people. Dave and Patty, they're just gorgeous. And they sadly lost a beautiful daughter named Ariella at the age of 15. She took her own life due to bullying.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. And little Ariella is... basically the catalyst for Froggert Yogurt. And if you've ever been there, they only hire teenagers. Well, they have some, you know, adults, but they mostly hire teenager employees. And it's a fun place you go. There's Disney Channel on the TV, and there's checkered games, and you eat yogurt. It's a fun place to hang out with for, you know, take your kids.
Where is it?
It's on Rodeo, Rodeo Family Plaza Medical Center, that whole little area.
Right, right. Here in Santa Fe, okay.
Yeah, here in Santa Fe.
And so they are sponsoring it, and they're really into all these kinds of girl power activities.
Yeah, they were very interested about us doing this empowerment, and it's called Girl Powers because we all have female DJs, but we want to empower everybody. Come dressed up as your superhero, make one up. Be a superhero you want to be. We're really encouraging dressing up to the point where it's $5 cheaper if you dress up. So it's just, we're really just encouraging of being dorky, but it's going to be fun, cool, dorky event, and... be awesome.
Excellent. Well, Angela Keene is the promoter of the event Girl Powers.
Along with Mark Afar. Sorry, he wasn't able to come today, but he's another promoter.
Oh, okay, yeah. Great. So it's an all ages electronic dance music show at Warehouse 21, and all kinds of other things are happening there as well. And it should be a terrific event.
I think it'll be fun.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.